So we've been in this series for the last few weeks, kind of this idea of the pursuit of happiness and walking through the Beatitudes, one of kind of the more revolutionary teachings of Christ when he first started teaching, and kind of looking at each of these individual aspects of the Beatitudes and trying to unpack that for our community and what that looks like and how that looks like lived out. And so this morning, we actually have a special guest with us. We have Kester, if you want to come up. And he's been here before, and we've gotten to hear him speak. And he's part of a community called Emmanuel, and I know we have some of their community join us every now and then. So he's going to help us unpack a little bit more this morning on the Beatitudes. So if we could give him a little warm welcome.
They never clap for me at my church. I like that. I probably like that too much. You guys should not do that. It's always good to be with you guys. It is always a blessing to me. You always make us feel so welcome, and I really appreciate getting the chance to be with you this morning. Gid asked me to speak on blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and I like that. There's an old adage that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. They used to, I can't remember, somebody's got to help me out. There was a commercial in the 80s that did some sort of play on it. The old adage is, you are what you eat, so you'd better eat right. And I feel like somebody, I was looking for it this week. I was going to show the clip and everything. It was going to be so great, and I couldn't find it. But I feel like there was a commercial where they said, you are what you eat, so you better eat light. And it was a whole, like, 80s boxed light foods thing. But I couldn't find it. I couldn't remember it. But so imagine that was incredibly cool. And then I just got done showing you that. I want to talk a little about you are what you eat, about becoming the things that we consume. And that's something that you hear growing up, or I heard growing up. It wasn't like constant, but, you know, it's out there. You hear it. You're familiar with it, but don't really take it to heart, or I didn't, until 2004 when I was diagnosed with diabetes. And then, like, suddenly what you eat becomes infinitely more important than it had previously been. And so I met with my doctor, and he started talking me through, okay, these are the changes we're going to have to start to make. We got to change your life. We started talking about exercise, and we started talking about diet, and we started talking about, you know, drinking less pop, which is hard for me because that's about all I subsisted on at the time. And we just talked about the changes that we need to make. And at one point, sort of half frustrated, half joking, but more frustrated than joking, so I guess not half and half, I said to him, man, what are you trying to do to me, Doc? And he looked at me kind of sternly, and he said, I'm trying to help save your life. And it was just one of those moments where it's like, oh, yeah, right. Like, this is inconvenient, and it hurts, and I don't like it, and I'm not used to it, but it's not like this guy just arbitrarily came into my life and said, okay, we're going to do a bunch of things you don't like. He's like, I'm trying to save you your life, man. I'm trying to make you well. As we come to Christ, we have to answer the question that Christ asks. If you are familiar with the story of the man who can't walk and he sits by the pool and he says to Jesus, you know, can you make me walk? And Jesus asks him this question. Anybody remember the question Jesus asks him? Do you want to be healed? Which seems like a stupid question. And so you have to dig a little bit, or I have to, because I assume Jesus is not a stupid person. But it seems dumb that here's this guy that comes, somebody brings him out to this pool where you're supposed to, if you can get into the water first. The way this works, if you don't know the story, is there's this pool, and if you can get into the water first, you're supposed to be healed of whatever it is that you need to be healed of. But this man can't walk, so of course he can't get into the pool as quickly. So he just comes out. Someone brings him out by this pool every day, and he sits by the pool, and he never gets well. And he asks Jesus, can you heal me? And Jesus says, do you want to be healed? And at first blush, it just sounds like, no, I just sit out here because I like hanging out by a pool. Like, what are you talking about? But Jesus understands, like, you understand that if you become a guy who can walk, you don't get to keep being the guy who can't. Like, if I heal you, your life is changed forever. And as much as you might not want to admit it, you might be used to being the guy who isn't healed. And you might like the idea of sort of hanging out at the place where people go to get healed, but not actually being healed. So I'm asking you the question, do you want to be healed? That can be my experience in church too often. Hanging out by the pool where people go to get healed, but not really wanting to get healed. And we get used to just sort of hanging out by the pool. And once we concede that that's what church is, then it becomes the job of guys like me to just make sure everybody is having as comfortable a time poolside as possible. But the question we really have to ask is, do you want to be healed? The question my doctor said to me in 2004 is, you want to die? Keep doing what you're doing. I'm trying to save your life. This last year, I changed my diet again. And this one was actually more difficult than the changes I had to make when I found out I was a diabetic. I became convinced upon reading a book that a vegetarian friend of mine said, you read this book and you won't be able to not be a vegetarian. And I was like, oh, bring it. You have no idea how much I like to eat meat. Like, nothing will convince me. And I read this book and I was like, oh, no. This book is right. I am going to become a vegetarian. And I did. And so I, like, made the commitment, and I told a bunch of people because I was like, if I tell people I'm one, then I'll just, they'll expect me to be, because I knew I didn't want to do it. And that's the thing with vegetarians. If you tell them that you think Christians, it's interesting because we will tell people sometimes, like, I believe in Jesus and I am a follower of Christ, but, like, if I don't actually follow Christ, people are like, oh, no, I get it. I mean, I understood when you said it. It didn't mean anything. But vegetarians actually expect it to, like, mean something. If you say, I believe eating animals is wrong, and I'm a vegetarian, you don't get to be like, but I eat bacon. And they're like, oh, it's cool. I get it. They're like, no, you know, make a choice. Eat bacon or be a vegetarian, but don't go telling people you're vegetarian. I actually have a friend. She was really excited. She was like, I'm so glad we're coming over to your house because I'm a vegetarian and nobody makes vegetarian stuff, and that's going to be great. And we got talking about it, and then she was like, well, I do eat bacon. No kidding. I'm not making that up. And I was like, well, you aren't a vegetarian then, right? She was like, no, I'm a vegetarian that eats bacon. I was like, what? No. If we get to do that, yeah, okay. And so there's this expectation of change of diet, change of lifestyle. And we have to embrace that. We have to embrace those changes. And for Christians, that can be hard when we're talking about hungering and thirsting for righteousness and hungering and thirsting for God, because we haven't necessarily taken the time to answer the question, do I really want to be healed? Do I really want to be a follower of Christ? Because we've set it up in such a way where, like, you can say, I'm a Christian and not be a follower of Christ, and we'll let you get away with it. We basically, what happens a lot of times too often as Christians is we say, I want Jesus. We don't actually say it because we know it would sound absolutely ridiculous, but we mean it without saying it, which is, I want Jesus to change my life in a general way without changing my life in any specific ways. We want there to be this sense that I am different somehow without actually being different somehow. And we just want to feel different. And Jesus comes and says, now I get that, but that doesn't really work. My question is, do you want to get well? My doctor's question is, do you want to live or you want to die? Because I'm trying to save your life. And so if I say I'm a Christian, but I don't pray, but I'm never in the Word, I don't really listen to God to guide me, I don't serve people who are in need, I don't know my neighbors, let alone love my neighbors, and people go, but I'm a Christian, and people are like, yeah, no, I get it. But Jesus comes saying, no, I don't get that. I want to know, do you want to be a follower of mine? Because it means something, it looks like something. Do you want to be healed? Now, as a vegetarian, that was really hard for me because, like, I had convinced myself I do not like vegetables. And so it's a weird thing for a guy. There was this friend of mine that was like, I can't stand this kind of vegetarian because just the kind of vegetarian that's like really doesn't like meat anyway and was like 10% there their whole life and then they decided to become a vegetarian, you're like, whatever, you didn't do anything. He said to me, he was like, it's not that hard. I mean, it's not like you're eating meat. 80% of your diet is meat. I was like, it's totally like that. 90% of my diet is meat. And then, like, vegetarians will lie to you and say things like, oh, you won't miss it, and you miss it. Like, I've been a vegetarian for 10 months. I miss meat every day. I miss bad meat, like midnight runs to Whataburger for sausage biscuits. Right? Oh, man, I don't even like talking about it. But you miss it. It's hard. And I had myself, I never ate, I mean, not never, but I never ate vegetables. I ate potatoes and we're like, yeah, I like vegetables, but no, come on. And so the choice then becomes, if I say I'm going to be a committed vegetarian because vegetarians take that thing kind of seriously, all right, well, I have to either, like, develop a new palate or I have to not eat and die. Like, those are my choices. Okay. So I decided to go with maybe I learned to like vegetables. But you have to develop a new diet. You have to develop new tastes. You have to develop a new palate. I had to develop a taste for vegetables, and it turns out I actually kind of liked them. I just had myself convinced that I didn't because burgers were available. The same thing is true for us as people who want to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Jesus says, do you want to be healed? What he's saying is, if you want to be new, it's going to be new. There's going to be a new way of being. There's going to be a new way of life. And do you want that? Do you want the kind of change that comes with that? And if the answer is yes, well, as people who maybe haven't hungered and thirsted for righteousness very much, we have to sort of cleanse our palate and develop a taste for it, develop a taste for God, because we have a taste for all these other things that are just empty. We got a taste for closets full of stuff and a taste for hours full of Facebook and TV and a taste for, you know, anger and laziness and greed. We just got a taste for so many things that when you say, I want to be a person who hungers and thirsts for righteousness, well, you got to develop a taste for it at first. We are a people who consume empty things. The thing I always think of is, I'm not picking on Coca-Cola here, but I think of Coca-Cola or just pop as an example of this, because it's a thing that you drink that because of what's in it makes you thirsty. All right? So, like, the more you drink it, it's not like if you drink water and it quenches thirst. The more you drink pop, the more, you guys don't say pop. I'm sorry. I'm totally throwing you off. Soda, Coca-Cola, whatever you guys. Everything's Coke in Texas, right? What kind of Coke you want? Dr. Pepper. What? Yeah. That's all right. I'm from Chicago. It's all pop. But it's empty. I mean, you've heard the phrase empty calories, and Coca-Cola, it's hilarious because it's literally a drink that you drink that will make you thirstier for having drunk it. And so you constantly need more, and yet you somehow feel full, but you aren't. And it's this weird sort of feeling. And we get to that place spiritually. We get to that place where we just feel like, I'm full, but like in an achy kind of gross way, but I don't feel full. Like somehow I'm bloated and empty at once. And I want something to be different. I'm hungry for something more. But we don't hunger and thirst for righteousness because we fool ourselves into thinking we feel full. And it can take a while for us to realize this just isn't doing it. We had this experience with the church that I pastor, Emmanuel, and people just, we were coming together week after week after week, and people were going, this isn't enough. Like, this isn't it. This just sort of putting in my hour and singing some songs, and then my life is just the same Monday through Saturday. That's not doing it. Like, this can't be it. Something is missing. And we started to think and talk and pray about what that something was. And it was developing that hunger and that thirst for God and for the kingdom that is coming, that hunger and thirst for righteousness and justice. And so we had to start off by just sort of cleansing our palate by saying, I'm going to have less of some of these things that I fill my life with that still leave me empty and wanting more. And I'm going to start developing habits and a lifestyle and a diet that has to do with a new way of life that helps me to hunger and thirst for righteousness, that helps me to, as Psalm 94 says, taste and see that the Lord is good. Well, sometimes you can't really taste that until you've sort of cleansed your palate a little. But we begin to develop a taste for God. And so what we came up with over a three-month period, prayerfully, thoughtfully, talked a lot, argued a little, was what we call the Emmanuel way of life. And what we wanted to be careful of is let's not develop this sort of arbitrary list of do's and don'ts or hoops to jump through, but things where what we said was it ought to be something any Christian could do, any Christian should do. And it ought to speak to us right out of the Word and out of the Spirit. We come together and talk about what this should be like. Now, Emmanuel is a sort of network of house churches. And so what we did, I have to tell the story just because I was really floored by this. We wondered, like, when you start putting together, here's a list of things we're all going to commit ourselves to, the thing that you worry about is, are we coming up with a sort of legalistic, pharisaical list of do's and don'ts, and we really don't want to do that, and we want to take great care with that. So what we did was, for a month, we had the individual house churches talking through this and praying through it separately, and then we all came together to talk about it and pray through it as one church. And the first week that we came together, we said, bring what you've come up with as a potential way of life for this church. And then we'll begin to sort of look at each other's, critique each other's, push and pull and prod and come up with something together. Well, we came into a room together for the first time, and we put our lists out there, and they were exactly the same. And it was one of those sort of chill bump moments where you're like, okay, maybe the Spirit's moving in this. Maybe we pay attention to this. And we came up with this list of things like, we will, as a church, commit ourselves, every individual member, to pray every day, to be in the Word every day. We will commit ourselves as a church to be serving in our community regularly. We will commit ourselves as individual members of a church to be having to actually know our neighbors, to have our coworkers into our homes or apartments, or to be on their turf if our apartments fit like us and a dog. But to figure out some way to meaningfully connect to the people in our lives outside of our church. We began to put together these certain ways that we could develop this way of life together. And what started to happen was we started to see people who began to hunger and thirst for righteousness. I mean, we had resistance, I'm not going to lie to you. But we have also begun to see people's lives change in really significant and powerful ways. We began to be this place where when you bring a group of people together and each and every one of them is praying every day and in the Word every day and putting themselves out in their communities and serving the people, something begins to happen in the life of that community. It begins to change. You begin to hunger and thirst for the righteousness of God. Now, because it's a list, the question that comes up when I talk to people about it is, well, can't that become just sort of an empty do's and don'ts ritual? Can't that be the same empty stuff you were talking about before? And the answer is yes, absolutely. If we aren't careful, it absolutely can. You think about Amos speaking on God's behalf, saying, I abhor your feasts and your festivals, and you get together and you sing these songs, and I'm just sick of it. And what does God desire? God desires justice. God desires righteousness. God desires for us to be a people who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And so as we live into this way of life, we live into it as people who want to get well. We live into it like friends of mine who are in AA, who don't look at the 12 steps as hoops to jump through. They look at it as 12 steps to getting well, to becoming the people they want to be, to walking in a new way of life. And we come together in that same spirit and say, I want to develop a taste for this, because what this has become for me, what Christian community has become for me, there's got to be more to it than this. There's got to be, because I feel achy full
but I feel empty.
If we hunger and thirst for righteousness, if we begin to fill up on God, we begin to ourselves be filled with righteousness. Now, not self-righteousness, not, man, I am so great, you guys should look at me and see the things that I'm doing for God and be impressed and humbled in my presence. That's not what we mean. But a like real righteousness that people outside of our Christian communities are blessed by the righteousness that's being poured out within us because it's spilling out of us. This never-failing stream of God's righteousness that Amos describes that flows into our lives and quenches our thirst and fills us up and spills out of us. You think people who aren't a part of our communities wouldn't be happy to see us coming if righteousness and justice were spilling out of our lives? I promise you that's good news. That's good news to anybody. And imagine if people started to say, I'm not even a part of that church, but if they go away, we're in trouble. And we begin to experience the good news of the gospel. This good news that feels, at first, maybe, because we're so not used to it. I mean, the good news that I have experienced, that I tell people who were non-vegetarians like me, is vegetables are good. Like, they really do taste good. And I did not believe that was true a year ago. And I just had to learn, you know, for a while it was just like, really? I'm going to eat broccoli because broccoli is a side dish and not a meal. And then you just find out, like, this stuff is good. Like, really, truly tastes good, fills me up, makes me better. Good. The good news that you discover as you begin to develop a taste for God, and I know that seems like a weird thing to talk about at church, but I'm telling you, we need to. As we begin to really develop a hunger and thirst for righteousness, is what we discover is, it is good. I like this. This makes me feel full in a good way. I like who this is making me. I like the way that Christ is working out salvation in me and in my life. I like that the fact that the way that Jesus is going to change my life in a general way is by changing it in all kinds of specific ways. He is making me new. And it feels good. I like it. But we're so used to, I was so used to my eating habits as a meat eater that it just felt bad at first. And we are so used to our own bad habits and lifestyle as those who may be followers of Christ but aren't followers of Christ that it can feel bad at first. We just don't know. But we can know. The good news is that we can begin to live into some disciplines and some into a way of life that helps us to develop a taste for the righteousness of God. We can form new habits, and really they're not new habits at all. They are ancient habits. If we'd been paying attention to the church at all over the last 2,000 years, you'd hear people who we all admire and want to be like going, well, I pray every day. Well, I put myself into God's word. Well, I love my neighbors. Well, I serve the poor. And we look at them and go, I want to be like that. And they're like, well, this is what that looks like. As we jump into that way of life, we discover, oh, yeah, this is good. This is the good life. This is what my wife, who's a co-pastor at our church, always reminds me of as we have begun this Emmanuel way of life. She's like, the verse I go back to again and again and again is Jesus saying, I have come that they might have life and have it abundantly. That this is not something like, I'm here to make your life harder, and I'm sorry. But it's the right thing to do, so suck it up and be a follower of Jesus. You know, that's not what it is. Jesus says, Satan has come to steal and to kill and to destroy. I've come to save your life. And give you new life and teach you to walk in a way of life that at first isn't going to feel right to you. But it's good. It's better. It's worth it. I think just a couple quick stories here. I think of a coworker of mine. I work at a bookstore, Book People, at 6th and Lamar. A coworker of mine who is not a Christian is, in fact, an atheist. And and pretty like staunchly. So, and he saw this story on the news like 2006 where the Amish community had a guy come in and shoot members of their community. And within the day, members of the Amish community had gone to be with this guy's, this shooter's family to make sure they were okay. And this staunch atheist coworker of mine came into work the next day, had been watching that story on the news, didn't know what to make of it, and said to me, "Kester, I think of the Amish as a particularly backward kind of people. And then I watch a story like that, and I wonder, are they here to show us the way? I think about a guy at our own church, Emmanuel, who struggles with his temper. And he's the guy that, like, he's going to bow up in a situation. And, like, you don't want to push him too far in a bar because he just will take this outside. I've literally never said to someone, "You want to take this outside?" He has said that a lot of times to someone's. Okay? He really struggles with it. And we talked about, as we go through this way of life kind of discussion, we talk about the things you're talking about with the Sermon on the Mount. And actually being someone different. And we treat it almost like the most fun, exciting, difficult homework you ever had. And we just we'll go through a passage and go, "We should just go try that." And we were looking at the passage about don't return evil for evil, but overcome evil with good. And he comes back the next week and he tells me this story. He tells us this story. He said, "You guys know I struggle with my temper. A year ago," he's a student at UT, "a year ago I'm on the UT campus, I'm with my girlfriend, the security guy tells me I'm parked in the wrong place, and he really sort of mouths off at me, and like sort of dismisses me like I'm an idiot for parking where I parked. So I just let this guy have it. I just screamed at him and yelled at him, and who did he think he was, and why didn't he get a real job, and et cetera." He said, "So this last week, I had an afternoon free, I walked to UT campus for 4 hours to find this security guard. And to say to him, I don't know if you remember this, but here's what happened a year ago. And I treated you in a way that Jesus would never have treated you. And I am trying to be a follower of Jesus. And I'm sorry." This is a guy whose life is changing. And not in some, "I get to keep throwing down in bars with people, but yeah, Jesus has changed my life" way. I'm going to spend 4 hours finding a security guard who's going to go, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't remember that." And I'm going to tell him, "Just know, Jesus would not have treated you that way. And as a follower of Jesus, I should not have either." We've got people in our church who, at one point in our short history, were right on the fringe of things. And just sort of, "Yeah, I'm here, and I'm not here, and I'm here." We began to walk in this way of life together, and they went, "Okay, if that's what it means to be a part of this church, I'm going to do it." And they're seeing their lives change. They're seeing their marriage get better. They've decided just recently, they said, "We just felt convicted. We wanted to have another kid, and we feel convicted. We're supposed to adopt that kid." People who just were kind of, "I'm just doing my life, leave me alone," whose lives are being completely changed by doing simple things like, "I'm going to pray every day and be in the Word every day and connect to God and connect to neighbor. And I'm going to wake up one day and find out, wow, God worked in that. God showed his grace to me in that." Because God's grace, we misunderstand this all the time. God's grace is not, "I'm going to leave you the way you are, but you get to go to heaven when you die." God's grace is, "I'm going to change you. I am going to save you. I am going to teach you to walk in a new way. And you will have life, and you will have it abundantly." I love this quote from this guy named Russell Maltby. He says, "Jesus promised his disciples three things: that they would be entirely fearless, that they would be absurdly happy, and that they would be always in trouble." And I think because we tried to skip the third one, we miss out on the first two. I don't want to be in trouble. I don't want to be at risk. I want to do the thing I do. Why am I not happy and fearless? But if we will embrace those things as a way of life, we will have life and abundantly. And so Jesus comes and he teaches me to pray, and he calls me to serve, and he commands me to love my neighbor and to speak truth to my brothers and my sisters. He calls me to take up my cross and to follow him, and he promises me that that will lead me to abundant life. But there will be times along the way still, even though I know better, where I am tempted to look at my brothers and sisters who hold me accountable to this Emmanuel way of life and say, what are you trying to do to me? And as my brothers and sisters, as the body of Christ, they will look at me and say, I am trying to save your life. If you find that being a part of a church has become something less than you expected it to be, if you find that your life is not as abundant as you hoped, I invite you to walk in a new way of life. And it's not my invitation, it is Jesus. Christ invites you to walk in a new way of life. And it is a better way. I'm telling you, it has changed my life. And it will change yours too. Thanks for letting me be here with you guys this morning. God bless you.